Now, if I say flat pack, you may conjure visions of horror that involve, I don't know, bookcases and Allen keys. We've all been in that pit of despair. Cast your mind back, however, to the 19th century, an entirely different proposition here. And we are talking of the portable building, never mind your bookcase. Prefabricated structures, kits of timber, iron and zinc that were shipped across the world to this part of the world via steamers, perhaps through the newly opened Suez Canal. It's an extraordinary tale of that great energy of that moment in history, in that middle and late 19th century. These buildings came to roost in places that urgently needed them. Houses, churches, lighthouses, houses of parliament. The outposts of colonial empire in particular. Yes, that's us. Only a handful of them still survive. And the bulk, right here in Australia, there's a campaign. They have more than 100 of them considered as part of World Heritage, UNESCO listing. Architectural historian Miles Lewis is co-writer of the draft bid for that heritage recognition. He joins us to tell us more. Miles, hello.
Fine. Good morning.
This is, it's almost unfashionable to say so, but this the 19th century, my goodness, they got on with stuff. They had tremendous industrial energy at that time.
Yes, the driving force was economics, really. It was the cost of building materials and the cost of labour. A lot of materials were brought to Australia anyway, so it's cheaper to apply the labour in Britain, where the labour is cheap, than in Australia.
So what was the need? And I'm wondering what the process is. There must have been businesses in Britain making these things, and you would look at a plan. How did the whole thing work?
Well, there's a huge variety. Timber buildings were being made quite traditionally in Europe for a long time, and they could be taken apart and moved. But in the 1830s and 40s, panelized systems developed where you had a standard panel size, standard column, and you could buy 10 windows and 14 panels and so on and make up a house to your own design. So that's the timber buildings. Mm. I should also mention that Singapore and Hong Kong also sent buildings, first to California to the gold rushes there and to Australia. And they were quite different. They were made by artisans. They bear numbers, especially Chinese numbers, but some Arabic numerals as well. And they're made of exotic timbers, which are unfamiliar today, Deraroo and Ringas and so on.
This is the thing. I mean, these were not sort of one size fits all. There were tremendous variety in these structures, and some of them quite grand.
Yes, well, the plate iron ones from Glasgow are enormously heavy, and they look like masonry buildings at first sight. You couldn't tell that they're made of iron.
On that subject of grandness, I mean, there's, for example, and many of the examples that are, you know, the buildings that are extant are in the Melbourne and Geelong area. There's one particular building in the Cario Way, which is extraordinary. Can you tell us its story?
Yes, this is Cario Villa at Geelong. It was made by Glasgow iron founders Robertson and Lister, who also made quite humble buildings. But Cario Villa is elaborately decorated, elaborate barge boards on the edge of the roof, all made in cast iron. Two faces are solid plate iron, and as I say, look like masonry. Mm. The backside, which you don't see, is very heavy corrugated iron. Now, the same company made tiny cottages, corrugated iron cottages. So there's a whole range of products. And what's so interesting is that there are about maybe a dozen of their buildings in Australia. And in Glasgow, where they came from, there's only one building by that company.
I mean, it's a testament to the construction that they've stood this test of time.
That partly that, and partly also that we had favourable conditions here, because lots of buildings went to California, but they were mostly destroyed in the San Francisco fires and later on by development. So we have here all the sort of range of buildings they had in California, which they can come and see. They haven't got them there.
Do we know, in broad terms, how many buildings of all types were imported into Australia in this period?
Look, I couldn't estimate. It was certainly many hundreds, and we have now about 100 surviving today.
The Suez Canal. We're talking about, you know, cast iron buildings, incredibly heavy sort of flat packs, more than you can put in the back of the VW Golf and take home from IKEA. These were massive constructions, even in their packed up form. How important is the opening of the Suez Canal in 1869 to this trade?
Not very, because most of them came before that time. The gold rushes before that time. The other similar connection was the Panama, not the Panama Canal, but the construction of a railway across the Panama Isthmus, which meant that from America, from Europe going by America or from the east coast of America, you didn't have to go down by the Cape of Good Hope. You could cross straight across the Panama Isthmus. Mm. It made a big difference.
This is a testament to the wealth of this place at that period, I guess.
Yes. I mean, the whole industry reflects, as I said, economics and political history. For example, the Crimean War. We have a few structures from the Crimean War, but the important point was that the price of iron doubled. So importation of iron buildings to Australia almost stopped entirely during the Crimean War.
Did that then resume?
Resumed at a much lower level.
You mentioned from Singapore, from Hong Kong, the use of exotic timbers and these sort of more artisanal structures. Tell us the story of one of those. There's one in Collingwood in Melbourne, I believe.
There's, in fact, about three standing in Collingwood. None are on the original site. They've all been rescued, and they were surviving in unrecognisable forms, you know, with modern cladding and so on. And the first one was found in 1982 at Mentone, having been moved already once from East Melbourne. But it was rescued by a private person, Andrew Muir, who assembled it, put it together again. It's been studied since, and he has now acquired at different times about three other buildings and a number of small components.
He's a bit of a collector.
He is, yes. But again, these are in Singapore, there are no remains at all. And we have great interest from Singapore in our proposal.
So 104 buildings in your proposal, is that correct?
Well, it comes up and down as we check them out, but about that, yes.
And that, I mean, Victoria has a preponderance of them. I suppose the gold rush, the boom period in this state had something to do with that?
Yes, the gold rush was the main attraction, but ironically, almost none of them actually got to the goldfields because there were no roads, no proper roads, no railways until a bit later. So they tended to all end up in Melbourne and Geelong, mostly.
One of the most extraordinary examples in this is the Legislative Council Chamber in the New South Wales Parliament. What's its story?
Well, this had been sent to Victoria as a warehouse, but then the New South Wales government bought it when they needed to build a building quickly. And this, again, it's one of these buildings from Glasgow, which looks like a masonry building. If you walk down Macquarie Street, you'll never guess it's an iron building, and only the facade was plate iron. The sides were corrugated iron.
I mean, one of the things I know about iron is that it rusts.
Well, it's not so serious with cast iron, which most of these are, more serious with wrought iron. Some of these buildings were galvanised, small elements were galvanised. That process had been invented, coating them in zinc. Some were primed with paint or fish oil and other materials, but by and large, the cast iron has stood well. It required ordinary maintenance, that's all.
Was this extraordinary technology at the time?
I suppose more in the extent of it. There had been lots of iron work done from the late 18th century, but the industrial scale of it was novel, and many of the details are novel as well. There are many patent details by individual makers.
And those patent details, how much of that was in the actual, you know, the big bits, and how much in the process of construction, the sort of the reassembly? That must have been fairly intricate.
There are details about the connections, how you fit them together, and there are details about the structural forms, like the roof trusses, which are quite novel. There's a form of truss called the Polonceau truss, which occurs in the works of one or two makers. But the connections are mostly the things that are patented, special ways of slotting them and joining them together. One extraordinary group of buildings have what look like sort of bicycle chains running horizontally, and you sort of bolt the side cladding onto this bicycle chain.
How extraordinary. It's still there.
There are a couple of them still standing, yes.
And when you ordered your building, did you just get a plan, or did somebody pop out on the boat with it to help you put it up?
A minority of them were actually ordered in that way. Most of them were speculative. They would be sent by an English manufacturer to a known merchant, say in Melbourne, and then advertised for sale. Only a few were custom made. Now, when they arrived, they mostly had drawings with them, and in the case of the Singapore ones, a lot of the Chinese carpenters came and some settled in Australia as a result. But they mostly had drawings with them. Sometimes you actually saw the building put up on the wharf and bought it. more commonly you bought an invoice. That is, you saw the description the shipper had sent and you took a punt on it and you bought the building and you got the packages and boxes and so on and hoped that what you got was the same as was described.
I suspect the returns policy could have been a bit awkward. With the speculative ones, were there ever little display villages, I'm imagining? Did they bring out several, put one up to show you what it looked like and sell the rest?
Yes, that was quite often done. And the other remarkable ones were the papier-mâché buildings, none of which unfortunately survive today. A whole village was designed in papier-mâché with a church and villa and so on to be sent to Melbourne. And that was published in England in the Illustrated London News, so you had an idea what the buildings looked like.
A papier-mâché, these were not intended for actual residents. These were an example?
They actually sent out actual buildings, and some of them were built in Melbourne. We find them in the old rate books. They were mostly timber-framed panels of patent waterproof papier-mâché cladding them.
What was the cost structure here? I mean, let's take, for example, that Corio Villa, that fabulous building near Geelong, iron and imported. The cost of constructing that locally, how would that have compared?
Well, the reason they came really was that at the height of the gold rushes, the building industry almost ceased. Everyone went to the goldfields, wages rocketed, and so it was worthwhile to import these buildings. Later on, they became very, very expensive. One building in Gippsland, I think, almost bankrupted the person who bought it, a sort of prestige iron building from Glasgow. But during the height of the gold rushes, they're an economic proposition.
Was there a bit of a, a status symbol in that? Look, I've got this imported iron building from Glasgow.
Oh, some of them certainly were, yes, the good ones. But they're very humble cottages as well. And surprisingly, some of those survived in the 20th century and became our first slums. The first slum inquiry reports illustrate some of these buildings, which are now regarded as absolutely terrible.
What need was that filling? I mean, I can understand perhaps the grander buildings and things like the Port Adelaide Lighthouse. There's a distinct need there. But for humble sort of workers' cottages, how did that come about?
Well, it was just ordinary housing. Plenty of migrants came who were really quite sort of well-off, middle-class type people, came to the goldfields and needed housing, and there was none.
So what's the process now? There's clearly a case here for the extraordinariness of these structures, and for Australia having so many extant examples, where do you go with your World Heritage bid?
Well, I suppose the first thrust has been to get international interest in them. So, for example, Germany sent a number of buildings here, and they have none back in Germany that we know of, and they're really quite varied and interesting. So we want to get support from Germany. We have support already from Singapore. Another came from the United States. And then the great majority came from England and Scotland, and I'm drumming up support there as we speak.
And significantly, you'll need to drum up support politically locally, I imagine.
There's plenty of support locally from individuals and bodies. The problem is to get the government machinery working.
Are they reluctant?
Well, it's hard to say. Heritage Victoria is just about to meet us, and they're expressing great interest. Hmm. It's taken a while to get them moving. But the Commonwealth government has huge sort of obstructions, bureaucratic processes of getting everything approved and all the states to sign up and that sort of thing. It's just very, very hard to get through the quagmire of red tape.
Well, Miles, it is an extraordinary undertaking, and these sound wonderful, magnificent relics of a remarkable period in this country's history. Let's hope that the powers that be see reason and put their shoulders to your wheel.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Miles Lewis, he's an architectural historian. He's emeritus professor at the Faculty of Architecture, Building and Planning, University of Melbourne. Prefab buildings in this country, many of them still here. What a remarkable story. This is Blueprint, Radio National.